thank you for being here on a Saturday morning. John set the scene. John set the scene. He laid out the conceptual basis for this incredible theory. And it depends on your point of view. It's an incredibly beautiful and elegant and simple theory, or it's absolutely horrendous. James took this theory and he applied it and he showed that it worked, that you can do maths with it, even though it seems impossible. And he showed that you can actually see some of the predictions of this theory. I'm going to look at probably one of the greatest success stories in modern theoretical physics, which is cosmology, the fact that we can derive a model, a mathematical model of the universe from first principles. But before I start, I just want to echo something that a pretty important relativist used to say in his talks. He died earlier this year, which is an important contribution of the general theory of relativity to cosmology has been to keep out theologians by a straightforward application of tensor analysis. And the point being that if you really want to work in cosmology, you need to do the math. Now, one of the interesting consequences of this is that the math can be quite unintuitive or unexpected. And when people first thought of working out the predictions for the universe in the 1920s, they got some interesting reactions. This is the Abbé Georges Lemaître. He was a Belgian priest who was seduced by Einstein's theory and started working on it in the early 1920s. And he decided to work out the mathematics, or he tried to solve the equations for the Einstein's equations for the biggest space-time of all, the universe. And he came up with some solutions, and he wrote them up, and he published them, and he sent a copy of his paper to Einstein. And Einstein, this was around 1926, 1927, he sent the paper to Einstein, and he didn't hear from him. In 1927, there was this very important conference in Solvay. There's a very important Solvay conference, and he met Einstein. And he met Einstein, and I think they caught a taxi together, and the Abbé Lemaître said, "Master, you know, what did you think of my work?" And Einstein said, "Your mathematics is correct, and your physics is abominable." And you need to do the maths, and sometimes the maths gives you something that you don't expect or you don't want. Now, just to point out why we have, you know, why you might want to look at the universe as one of the first problems you tackle with Einstein's theory. Let me just remind you what you do in Newtonian theory. And so, do you still have your pointer? With Newtonian theory, we've spoken about this 1 over r squared law, and there's another way of thinking about it, which is quite useful, which is you talk about the gravitational potential, and James spoke about the gravitational potential, and he mentioned the Newton-Poisson equation. In other words, if you've got some density of matter, if you want to find out what the gravitational potential due to this density of matter is, you solve the Newton-Poisson equation. And this is a linear partial differential equation. You find this thing. You can work out the force that acts on a body of mass small m, and it's simply that. And then you just use second law to find out what that body is doing in that gravitational potential. It's dead easy, very simple. It's the simplest thing you could do. And you do have a partial differential equation, but it's linear. Now, what happens in general relativity? Well, there's the things that we say, and we say it's geometry equals energy. We have space-time, we put stuff in the space-time, it deforms space-time. Wheeler encapsulated, John Wheeler, who was this, you know, iconic relativist, encapsulated what GR is by saying space-time tells matter how to move, matter tells space-time how to curve. And this is one of the transparencies that John put up, basically saying this is what GR is. And this is the simple way of talking about GR. The less simple way is actually looking at the maths. And as John said, we talk about this thing, the metric, which is this 4x4 matrix. All of these things are functions of space-time. And because this thing is symmetric around the axis here, there are 10 free functions of space and time. If you remember, he explained that one of the fundamental objects was the Ricci curvature. But what is the Ricci curvature, the Ricci tensor? Well, it's this horrible nonlinear operation on this metric. And I just wrote down a few terms. You have derivatives of the inverse of that thing times the derivative of that. You have derivatives with regards to x naught, x1, you have cross terms. Each component of the Ricci tensor is 208, sum of 288 terms, which are nonlinear, derivatives, products, etc. That's what you have to work with. And then you bung that into Einstein's equations, and you can imagine, you can see what you get. You have the Ricci tensor there. This is just the contraction, the trace of that Ricci tensor. This is the energy momentum tensor that John mentioned, where you have the mass density. This is kind of the analog of the Newton-Poisson equation, and it's a mess. You have to solve this. And I'm just going to repeat something that both my colleagues said. It is only very recently that we have been able to solve one of the simplest problems in classical mechanics, the two-body problem that you do in your first year. Only in 2005 were people able to solve the problem of two masses orbiting each other in a space-time, self-consistently, solving for the movement of the masses and the space-time. Only in 2005 on supercomputers. So it's really, you know, it's a mess. Now, what do you do when you have equations like this? Well, when you have equations which are complicated, you simplify. And in James's case, he assumed a certain simplification. He looked at the weak field limit. He looked at the weak field limit, which involves taking a space-time that you know, Minkowski space, and then perturbing around it, looking at linear at small fluctuations around it and looking at the linearized equations. He did this. I'm going to do something else. I'm going to take hold of Einstein's equation. I'm going to find a symmetry, use it to greatly reduce the complexity of the equations, and then solve it. And the symmetry that I'm going to appeal to is the cosmological principle. And the cosmological principle has two bits. Imagine a moment in time in our universe, and let's assume that all the universe looks the same anywhere. In other words, at any place. If I measure the density here, curvature here, the pressure here. If I measure the density, pressure, curvature over there or any point, they're exactly the same at any point in space. In other words, all the quantities at any moment in time, all your quantities take the same value in space. The other component ingredient is isotropy. In other words, if I look in one direction and I measure the intensity of light or the temperature or the pressure or density in that direction, I do the same thing in that direction, in any direction, I measure exactly the same thing at any moment in time. If I combine these two things, that means that I'm kind of constraining the type of space-time that I can look at. And I'm really constraining it quite brutally. For a start, as I said, it means that when I look at the energy density and the pressure, the things that drive source Einstein's equation, they can only be a function of time. If I look at my 4x4 metric, which is, I remind you, it's got 10 free functions of space and time, it reduces to something like this. Basically, there are no off-diagonal components. All the x, y, and z components look the same because none of these directions is privileged, and it's only a function of time. And I'm left with one function of time. And this function is what we normally call the scale factor. And we call it the scale factor because it's quite easy to understand what this scale factor means. Let me rewrite that metric in this way. I've got the time component here, and I have the scale factor here multiplying my spatial part. If I draw a grid in these x, y, and z components, let me just consider a two-dimensional slice of this. So let's forget z, just in x and y. I can draw a 3x3 grid, and I can look at this grid at different moments in time. And all this metric is telling me is that this grid will either expand or contract, but the grid stays essentially the same over time. In other words, this is just the case of an expansion. Suppose that this is an ordered time, t1, t2, t3. All that this space-time is saying is that that grid, at one moment in time, will evolve to a grid at another moment in time, and it'll just expand in this homogeneous and isotropic way. This is what this metric looks like. And this A rescales that grid, the scale factor. Now, we've simplified the metric. By simplifying the metric under these symmetries, it turns out that we greatly simplify the equations. This is the 0,0 component of the Ricci tensor, and it turns out that this thing, this beast that has 288 terms, simplifies so dramatically that it's just one term. A double dot is the second derivative of the scale factor with regards to time, and you divide it by the scale factor. If you look at one of the spatial components, R11, well, any of the components, they all look the same. And again, it's going to be very simple. I have a double derivative of the scale factor here and a single derivative of the scale factor there squared. So it greatly reduces the math. It simplifies things dramatically. And if you bung that into Einstein's equation, remember that John showed this. You had R mu nu minus 1/2 G mu nu R. You bung that in there, and that's all you get. You get A dot over A squared equals 8 pi g rho. You have the energy here, the geometry here, energy driving the geometry. If you do that, if you add the 0, 0 components with a combination of the spatial components, you get an equation that looks like an acceleration equation. You've got A double dot here, and then you've got the stuff that's driving, that's filling the universe. And these are your two basic equations. With these equations, we have an incredibly powerful mathematical model for the universe. So let's try and solve this model for a simple situation. Let's just assume that our universe is full of a gas of particles and that these particles have a mass, all have a mass m. Furthermore, let me assume that these particles are massive, that their velocities are so small that they're negligible. In other words, the dominant component of energy for each of these particles is its rest mass. I lay these out, and I'll have that in some slice of the universe, some block of the universe, the total rest energy in that block will be the mass of those particles times c squared. And I want to find the energy density, which is the thing that goes into Einstein's equation. I divide it by the volume. And the volume, as I showed you in that grid, that volume changes with the scale factor. So it's three dimensions, so there's a factor of A in each dimension. And let me just assume an L equals 1. Let me start with a unit volume and changes with time. That volume will change with a factor of A cubed. And so what I find is that the energy density goes as 1 over A cubed. And the equation that I had for you was this one here. If it changes as 1 over A cubed, well, let me just define a constant rho naught over A cubed, bung it in there, multiply by A squared to get rid of the 1 over A squared from over here, and I get this incredibly simple ordinary differential equation. That, in the spirit of what my colleagues have been saying, in a Michaelmas term of the first year, you should be able to solve. And you solve it, and you find that the scale factor goes as t to the 2/3. It grows with time. The first thing that you notice is that the scale factor changes with time. It's not static. Your universe is evolving. That's one of the first great predictions from solving these equations. The other interesting thing that we haven't really gone into, and I'm not going to go into, is if I wind back the time at t equals 0, that scale factor goes to 0. In other words, the whole of space the whole of space contracts to a point. This is the singularity that John was mentioning. Now, I fudged this a bit, because I said homogeneity and isotropy give you a metric like this. It turns out that this is one of possible three metrics that I can consider. And it turns out that there's a very powerful mathematical theorem that says the only possible homogeneous and isotropic spacetimes in three dimensions are the following. We have the metric that I had there, which is basically the Euclidean metric. The Euclidean metric is the Euclidean space is the space that you learnt in high school. The space where the sum of the angles of a triangle are 180 degrees, where parallel lines stay parallel. But you have two other possibilities. You can consider what is a hyperspherical surface. And this is basically, the way to think about this is the surface of a three-sphere embedded in four dimensions. Okay? Those four dimensions are not space-time. It's just a useful way to look at it. And of course, because you can't put this on a paper, it's very difficult to visualize. This is a two-sphere. This is the surface of a two-sphere. So imagine the one dimension up of this object over here. And there you see that the geometry is different. For example, clearly the angles of the triangle don't add up to 180 degrees. If you try to start off with two lines which are parallel along the equator, they'll intersect at the pole. So it's a different geometry. There's the opposite curvature to that, which is a saddle, a higher dimensional saddle, a three-dimensional hyperboloid embedded in a four-dimensional space, which also has different properties to these. And these are the only three spaces. We use the term manifolds. These are the only two manifolds that we can consider, which are homogeneous and isotropic. Now, these modify that equation that I gave you. The equation that I gave you that we solved and which we derived is that A dot over A squared equals that. And it turns out that the actual curvature of space affects the expansion as well in this incredibly simple form. And that term depends on this constant k, which is proportional to the radius of curvature of that three space. Okay. And if we solve these equations, well, we did one solution, which was the case where k equals to zero, and it's this yellow line here. It grows as t to the 2/3. But what's really interesting is what happens if you consider different curvatures. For example, suppose you can consider the curvature of the hypersphere. you consider the curvature of the hypersphere, that's positive. So you have a negative thing term here. So as this grows, as this evolves, at some point this is equal to that, and A dot is equal to A. In other words, expansion stops. And what you get is a universe that expands, reaches a maximum point, and recollapses. On the other hand, if the surface we're looking at is a hyperboloid, this has a negative sign, so that just adds, and what you get is a universe which is expanding, and then at some point, at later times, just expands at a constant rate. And you can see it expands at a constant rate, because if you get rid of that, you can cancel the A's there, and you just get A dot squared equals KC squared. Now, there's a way of understanding this. There's a kind of intuitive way of looking at these equations, which is high school maths, again, in the spirit of my colleagues. This is the equation we're looking at. Let's just multiply by A squared throughout, so we end up with that over there. Then let's multiply by a half, and let's bring this to the other side, so we get a half A dot squared. That looks like a kinetic energy. And then let's try and bundle these things up in a way that looks useful. So if we imagine the mass in a ball of radius 1 with density rho naught, we know that that is going to be rho naught times 4 pi over 3, so set L equals 1. And so I can just define a mass in that way. And what I end up with is gm over A here. And then I leave that on that side. And let me just call that the total energy. And what I have is a kinetic energy plus the potential energy in a central potential. And this is just a mechanical problem that you're familiar with. This is the problem of throwing up a ball on the surface of the Earth. And this plot, this graph, shows you what you would expect. Imagine that you throw up this ball. And I'm going to turn this a little bit around. You throw up this ball with a certain velocity. If the Earth is incredibly massive, what will happen is this ball will go up, and then it'll fall down, and it'll fall towards the center. And this is what we see here. And this corresponds to the case of the hyperspherical universe. If we throw this ball up, and the Earth is much less massive, it's not very massive at all, it's very easy to throw it up with enough velocity for it to break out into orbit. And it'll break out into orbit, and it'll just coast away at a constant velocity at some point. If we throw this ball up, and the balance between the velocity and the mass is such that it's just right, you will throw it out, and this ball will coast out to infinity, and as it reaches infinity, it reaches zero velocity. And these are the three world models that you get from this theory. And one of the things that you will note is that you always seem to get deceleration. You always get some pulling. The case where you get the least pulling is the open case, but you always get some pulling. And this is, not surprising. We're still talking about gravity. But you might ask the question, is it possible to get some pushing? Is it possible for the universe to accelerate? Now, John mentioned that this was Einstein's equations. This was r alpha beta minus 1/2 g alpha beta r. But actually, you can also add this term. And that in all honesty, the Fool's theory, if you want to keep all the terms which are consistent, you have to add this term. And this term is this lambda is what's known as the cosmological constant. And you can you do the same game that we played before, look at homogeneous anisotropic universe, and you've got the density here, you've got the curvature here, and then you've got the cosmological constant here. This cosmological constant does something incredibly interesting. Let's ignore this bit for now, and we've got a universe that looks like that. And now let's assume that where it's sufficiently late times that this is so big that this is small. What you find is that you get A double dot over A equals lambda over 3, and you can solve that, and you'll get two solutions, but the dominant solution is one which grows exponentially. In other words, you'll get A accelerating. And again, let's look at our ball analogy. You now have to add to the kinetic term and the central potential term, you have to add this term here, which grows with distance. And so this was our positive curvature universe, no curvature, negative. If you throw it with exactly the right, if you have a large enough lambda, what will happen is this ball will just fly away faster and faster and faster and faster. So it's pretty bizarre. But it's a possibility that you have to consider. And the reason that Einstein came back to this cosmological constant is not an innocent reason. Basically, he came up with this theory in 1915, and at some point he wanted to try and understand Mach's principle that John mentioned. And the way to think about it, just think of, again, the model for the whole of the universe. And he didn't like that. He had this prejudice, and this prejudice that the universe was static, that things, you know, the universe had to be static, that there couldn't be any of this evolution. There was, according to him, and he just didn't know what was going on, that there wasn't any evidence for evolution. And so if you think about it, it's kind of intuitive. You know, you've got the pull of ordinary matter, you have the curvature doing something, you want something to give it a push. So he added in the cosmological constant, and it turns out there is a solution to this equation. If you pick the energy density to have this value, and you pick the scale factor to have this value, both A dot and A double dot are equal to zero. So he proposed a static model of the universe. Now, Lemaître showed that this model, indeed, this is indeed a solution, but unfortunately, it's unstable. If you just tweak the energy density a little bit, or the cosmological a little bit, it'll either collapse very rapidly, or it'll fly apart. And that's why when Lemaître met Einstein, Einstein wasn't happy, because Lemaître had this paper showing the static solution isn't really a good solution because it's unstable. You have to consider all these evolving solutions, and Einstein didn't want the universe to evolve. So, the big conclusion is the universe must evolve. How do we look for this? Well, the universe is expanding. I described this mesh, and that the scale factor is changing the scale of this mesh. Let's pick two galaxies, and they're moving away from each other. Let's just think of the problem in terms of one spatial dimension, the dimension between the galaxies, and we have that the invariant distance is given by that. The physical distance between the two galaxies is described by the scale factor times this mesh distance, this invariant mesh distance. And one thing you can do is just work out the velocity between these two galaxies. If you take the time derivative of this, you take the time derivative of that, it's the time derivative of that thing over there. That's just that delta S is just the mesh distance. That doesn't change with time. So you just get a time derivative of the scale factor. Multiply and divide by A. If you divide by A, you have it here. You multiply delta X by A, and you get L again. And so you get this very interesting law that the velocity of the two galaxies is proportional to their distance. The further away galaxies are, the quicker they are moving away from each other. Well, the first statement is they will move away from each other with a certain velocity, and the second is there is this relationship. The other interesting thing you can do is you can look at these two galaxies, and you can imagine that you know these two galaxies are moving away from each other, and one of them is sending a photon to the other. You can measure you assume that you know the emission, the emitted wavelength of this photon. Because they're moving away from each other, there's a Doppler effect. And you can write a differential version of that. You have the velocity here between the two. But you can use Hubble's law to replace that by A dot over A times the distance. But you have dr over C is the distance traveled between the two galaxies or during that time. A dot is dA over dt times dt. So you can cancel out the dt. So you get a dA over A. You integrate that. And you get that the wavelength goes as the scale factor. In other words, in an expanding universe, the wavelength of photons is stretched. And we often talk about this quantity, which is the redshift, which is basically how much the observed versus the emitted of the observed photon wavelength changes with regards to the emitted one, or the difference in the scale factor between the emission and the observation of those photons. And how would you observe this? You would look at light emitted by a distant object. You kind of guess that object is going to be made of molecules and atoms that you know. And not only that if you know these atoms and molecules, you know what their emission lines, you know what their spectra look like. And you measure the position of these spectra of the light emitted by this object relative to what you measure in the laboratory. So in the laboratory, which is here, z equals zero is here, you see certain lines. If it was emitted at some redshift, these lines will be pushed to longer wavelengths. And so the ratio between these two will give us the redshift, which also give us the speed at which these objects are moving away from each other. So that'll give us the speed at which these objects are moving away from each other. So we can do this with a galaxy, we can measure its speed. The other thing we need is the distance. And the way to do that is that we know that the further away an object is, the dimmer it is. If we have some way of knowing what its fundamental brightness is, how much light it's pumping out as a function of time, and we can measure its brightness, the flux that we're measuring here, we know we can figure out the distance. And we can do that because if you imagine that this thing is pumping out light isotropically in all directions, and you you draw a little area over there, you know that a certain number of photons go through here. Imagine now that for you to collect the same number of photons further away, you have to have a larger collecting area. In other words, if you take the same area that you had here to be over here, the amount of photons you'll be collecting will be smaller, and it'll go down as a function of the area. And the distance, the amount that it goes down by is related to the distance. And so by measuring the flux, we can measure the distance. The flux will be proportional to the amount of light being pumped out over the area, which means the flux will be over the distance squared. So measuring the flux relative to what you think the intrinsic amount of light it's being pumped out of gives you an estimate of the distance to this object. Now, I said that Einstein assumed that the universe was static, but he wasn't really paying attention to what was going on at the time. And an interesting fact is that this guy, Vester Sliver, was an astronomer at Flagstaff, Arizona, and he was looking at what are called nebula. Nebula, it wasn't clear. There were these smudges in the sky, and people weren't clear what those objects were. Were they galaxies? Were they star-forming regions? They weren't sure what they were, but there were lots of them. And he decided to measure their velocities by measuring this effect, this redshift effect. And what he found is basically that 21 out of 25 nebula were redshifted. In other words, 21 out of 25 nebula were moving away, were flying away. So this is the first evidence that there's kind of this coherent effect on the sky that stuff is moving away from us. Lemaître, when he wrote his paper, took Slipher's data and some measurements of distance to some of these objects, and he worked out the slope of that curve. Remember that the velocity goes as h times the distance. And he worked out that h. And what he found was that it was about 625 kilometers per second per million parsecs. And I'll tell you what that means in the next slide. What is interesting is that he had that calculation in 1927. Eddington, the Eddington of the Eclipse expedition that James told you about, translated his paper in 1931. And dropped that thing. You didn't include that calculation. And what is interesting is that 2 years later, Edwin Hubble, an astronomer at Caltech, set out to measure this, look for this relationship. And this is a plot from his paper. And so again, you have here distance in parsecs, and here you have velocities. This is the data over here, and this is the line. You know, okay. Granted, this is a scatter plot, so it's a little bit ambitious for him to do this, but he did this. And just to give you an idea of the scale of these things, so this is 10 to the 6 parsecs. A parsec is about 3.26 light years. So we're looking at incredible distances. If we summarize, this is a more modern rendition of that data set. And again, it becomes pretty clear that it is a scatter plot. And the reason that this is a scatter plot is that these galaxies not only have the motion due to the fact that the universe is expanding, but they're also being pulled and pushed by local gravitational potentials. And Hubble fit this line, and he found that the slope was 550 kilometers per second per megaparsec, and that was the number he got. Now, what is interesting about this number is that it's pretty much completely off what it is, okay? And one of the ways of seeing that it was possible to see that it was off, that there was a problem, was already then, was you can do the following. You have the Hubble law here, and remember that h is a dot over a. We've solved Einstein's equation, if you remember, and we got t to the 2/3. So we can calculate what this h is. We just take the derivative, and you get 2/3 over here, and you get t to the minus the 1/3. And then you divide by a, you divide by that. And so you get that the Hubble constant is 2/3 of 1 over t naught. This is the age of the universe. This is the time since the beginning, since A equals zero, since the universe started expanding. And this is the measured Hubble constant. We can invert it. And what this gives us is quite remarkable. It says that we can find the age of the universe from a measurement of the Hubble constant if we assume the simple model, which is kind of a commonsensical model. And if you plug in Hubble's measurement, what you get is that the universe is about a giga year old. Now, already then, there were from geochronological datings, there was evidence that the universe was between 3 and 4 giga years old. So what Hubble was finding was that the universe, according to this model, was younger than the stuff that it contained. And that was a problem that lasted for many decades. Again, this is the Hubble data. This is what it looks like. Well, this is kind of an equivalent data set using supernova, very bright explosions. So we can look at very far far star. And it's just it's remarkable. The distances, remember in Hubble's plot, it went out to 123 megaparsecs. We're going out to 500 megaparsecs. The velocities are incredible. And it's just bang on a line. Okay, this is what we see. Hubble's law is there, and it's real. And it's predicted from general relativity. Now, if you've got this universe, which is expanding, and one of the things you can say is, well, this universe contains stuff. What if I wind back the clock? What's going on? Well, if you wind back the clock, you can use some simple thermodynamics to infer what happened at early times. If you remember from your second year thermodynamics, so Michaelmas term, if the expansion is adiabatic, there's a very simple relationship between the pressure and the velocity, and this is the adiabatic index, which is you derive from the specific heats of the system that you're looking at. That thing is a constant. And you can use the ideal gas law to replace V by T, and what you get is another conservation, that temperature times volume to some power gives you this. Let's consider a gas of photons. What you get is then that the temperature goes as, and remember that the volume goes as A cubed, so you get that the temperature goes as 1 over A. So at smaller a, earlier in times, temperature is higher. The universe was hotter in the past. And if the universe was hotter in the past, this means that physics was probably different in the past. And the simplest theory model that you can look at is imagine that the universe is full of electrons and protons, and that at very early times, the electrons and protons form hydrogen atoms. At very early times, the universe has a very high temperature, which means that protons and electrons there's too much energy for them to combine to form hydrogen. At low temperatures, they form hydrogen. In other words, at very early temperatures, the universe is formed of free protons and free electrons. At late times, it's formed of hydrogen. And the transition is obviously the binding energy of the hydrogen atom. A way to think of what happens in this universe is, as I said, at early times, one way of thinking about it is in terms of the ionization fraction. NP is the number density of free protons in the universe. NH is the number of protons in hydrogen atoms. And so this is the number of free protons over the total number of protons in the universe. At early times, it's very hot. All the protons are free. At late times, it's very cold. All the protons are bound in hydrogen. So this is zero. So this ionization fraction is one at very early times. And then it falls to zero. And it falls to zero when the universe is about 380 thousand years old. And the fascinating thing about this is we have seen evidence for this. And we've seen evidence for this because the universe was very charged at early times. It was this ionized plasma. It falls to neutral hydrogen. There's all this light left over from that time. And this light, which was highly interacting, was in thermal equilibrium. If you remember your STATMEC, so Hilary term, you describe a gas of photons in thermal equilibrium in terms of the Planck spectrum, a black body spectrum. It looks like this. You have the Rayleigh-Jeans law here, and then you have the Planck bit over here. These are measurements. This is the discovery of this relic light left over from the Big Bang by Penzias and Wilson, who won the Nobel Prize for this discovery, and then another team a year later at Princeton, and it's bang on this black body spectrum with a temperature of about 3 degrees Kelvin. And the current measurement of this is just really remarkable. So again, this is the Planck spectrum, okay? And these dots are measurements of the FIRAS instrument on the COBE satellite, which flew late 80s, early 1990s. And these are the data points. Now, let me point out the following. First of all, the centers of the data points lie bang on the theoretical curve. It has some errors on here. These are not the real errors. The errors have been multiplied by a factor of 400, so you can see them. Okay. If I hadn't done that, the data points would be within the line width of the theory. Okay. So this is the best measured black body spectrum. Measured black body spectrum ever. Now I mentioned the accelerating universe. Let's do one final bit of mathematics. Let's take our expression for the scale factor and let's tailor expand it around today. So we have the first term, then we take the derivative and it's times t minus t naught, t is some time in the past. And then we have the second derivative, and I hope you remember Taylor expansion, first year Michaelmas. We can set the distance that, and imagine that we're looking at some photon emitted at some time t. The distance, the luminosity distance that it travels is going to be the speed of light times t naught minus t. And remember that I define this thing, the redshift, as 1 plus z is a over that, so I've just inverted it here. I define the Hubble constant as a dot over a, and I'm going to define something called the deceleration parameter. And the deceleration parameter is a double dot times a over a dot squared. So you can see there that there's a bit of the deceleration parameter there. And if I replace all the c's and t's and all this in here, I get an equation that looks like that. 1 over 1 plus z, 1 minus, I have the Hubble constant there, and then I have here an amalgama of the Hubble constant with a deceleration parameter, and I have dl and dl squared here. And now let me simplify this a bit and just Taylor expand the scale factor, and what I get is z equals a linear term in dl and a quadratic term in dl squared. Forget this for now. Multiply by that by c, and what I get is a velocity. And so I get velocity equals Hubble constant times the distance. It's the Hubble law, all right? But now I have a quadratic correction over here. And the quadratic correction is dependent on one of the things that affects the quadratic correction is the deceleration parameter. I could have expanded it and inverted. I can invert this equation, and what I get is the distance is going to be proportional to the redshift plus a term in the redshift squared. And that term in the redshift squared has the deceleration parameter. So if we can measure deviations from the Hubble law, quadratic deviations from the Hubble law, we can pin down this thing here, this deceleration parameter. And it turns out that in 1998, some astronomers did that. They look at very distant supernova, and they have a way of figuring out the distance to this supernova, and they constructed this velocity distance plot. And so here we have the redshift, and here we have the distance. And what they found is that they could measure this quadratic correction, this deviation from the Hubble law. And what they found was that the universe was accelerating. Remember that those simple models that I have, the universe is always decelerating, gravity pulls. What they were finding is that the universe was accelerating. Well, they won the Nobel Prize for this, but one of the consequences is that we seem to live in this bizarre universe where a large fraction, a possible explanation for this acceleration is the cosmological constant that Einstein brought in at some point. And a large fraction of that of the universe, of the energy density of the universe, has to be in that cosmological constant. Now, you might argue this is great because, you know, it was there all along. You know, we have a solution. We have a completely consistent model of the universe. And this is, you know, this is just showing you what I showed you before. If you have the cosmological constant, you'd get acceleration. So cosmological constant explains everything. But it turns out that it's a huge problem. Because if you actually look in detail at the maths and the physics that go into the Einstein's equation, we live in a universe which is full of stuff. And one of the things that we've learned about stuff, and in particular about quantum field theory, is that the vacuum has energy. Quantum fluctuations of the vacuum have energy. And that if you, that's the first thing. The second thing is you remember that Einstein's equations say that geometry equals energy. So all energy has to go into there. So we have to put in those vacuum fluctuations, the energy due to those vacuum fluctuations. And so you can calculate the energy due to those vacuum fluctuations, and it looks just like a cosmological constant. So we can pick a cosmological constant, whichever cosmological constant that we want, we will also have to take into account the energy density of the vacuum fluctuations, which looks like a cosmological constant. And if you work it out, it's basically proportional to the mass, to some, whatever your highest mass in your theory or your mass in the universe is, to the fourth power. Now, let's make our lives easy. Let's imagine that the heaviest particle in the universe was the electron. And if we choose the mass of the electron and you bung it into this calculation, we basically find that the cosmological constant due to these vacuum fluctuations is order 10 to the minus 22 per meter squared. The cosmological constant that explains the acceleration of the universe that we observe is 10 to the minus 52. In other words, there's 30 orders of magnitude difference between something that we expect to be there. I mean, at the moment, we have no understanding why it isn't there, and what we actually observe. And another way of thinking about it is if indeed the vacuum fluctuations were of this order, the universe would have accelerated so much in the past that we wouldn't exist. And this, for some, it's a curse. For me, it's a blessing, because it means there's lots to do. We need to solve this problem. And it has become one of the really active fields in theoretical cosmology to try and understand the cosmological constant problem and the source of acceleration in the universe. This is Einstein's field equations again, and what do people do? Well, one possibility is that you add something in to fix the problem, and over a decade or more, people are proposing that you add in some scalar field, something like the Higgs, such that it has a potential energy and a kinetic energy. The kinetic energy is very small at late times, and the potential energy is tuned in such a way that not only can it, in some sense, fix the cosmological constant problem, but give you the right acceleration. A more ambitious project is to say, well, actually, we don't have the correct theory. Gravity is wrong. Gravity is wrong, and so we need to modify Einstein's theory of general relativity. And you can imagine there are multiple ways of doing that. You can add corrections to this, but one of the things that some people have proposed is that maybe gravity screens vacuum energy. It doesn't see these vacuum fluctuations, so that's not important. But then you've got to get accelerated expansion somehow. So you have to do this combination of not get acceleration and get acceleration at the same time. And again, this is a very active field of research. Well, I'm going to finish off with a quote by John Ruskin, which is, remember that the most beautiful things in the world are the most useless. Now, John Ruskin didn't know what he was talking about because he wasn't a physicist. But, it depends on your perspective. I think that this is an incredibly beautiful theory, and it has really produced some of the most fantastic results in modern physics. And so I'll end there.